only children, I mean, the only parents in Mount Brook care about their children.
Right, I agree.
So I'm glad you're here. And thanks so much for reminding me. It's probably been maybe 6 years ago that I did a video version of this, and so this is the link to it, which I'm glad you feel free to share. And it's the whole series is at that link. And it's a little bit outdated, you know, because it did 6 or 7 years ago, but it's out there, and I need to redo it at some point. God, I don't know when I have time. I'm supposed to be retired, but there's no sign at all that I'm retired. I'm on three different payrolls. Anyway, enough about me. Remember, we talked about what looks like an ideal intervention program for people with ADHD. I've said a zillion times, and I won't beat this to death, almost nobody gets all this, but it certainly is what ought to happen in a world where we're doing the right thing by our kids with ADHD. So I want to focus today on some things about sort of school and also about home and parenting. And let me just say that I just have a ton of stuff to go over today. So I'm not going to say don't ask a question, but just understand we've got a lot to do. And so if you have a question, how about this? If you ask me a question, let me reserve the right to wave off your question because it would just take too much time to try to answer. So, all right, so speaking of ideal things, in general, what should a child with ADHD be getting from his or her local school? One thing, you know, and I don't mean to beat this to death, but in an ideal school situation, everybody, all the adults, would, and the student with ADHD, the child with ADHD, would be educated about it. And again, I feel like I beat that to death, how little of that actually goes on. And I'll say a little bit more about that later, just a couple slides down the road, when I suggest to you some things that you ought to talk to the school about. And one of the things I'll say is, you absolutely have the right. You have the right to ask any question you want. And so one question you can ask is, when was the last time your staff was trained on ADHD? Right, it's a fair question. I mentioned before, there's a conference that I participate in. I'm on the planning committee. It happens every year in Tuscaloosa. It's a major, big conference. People from all over the country come. And I'm supposed to be an expert at ADHD, you know, and every time I go, I learn a bunch of new stuff. My point being, if your principal at school says, well, they attended a training, you know, 4 years ago, my question would be, what about the people you've hired in the meantime? You know, so I don't mean to be throwing my own school district under the bus, but those are fair questions, you know. And it's a problem everywhere. And there's a lot of good reasons for it I want to get into. One is escalating legal demands of what we have to train teachers on. It's kind of like, when do we have time left to actually teach? Because we have to do so much mandatory training. So it's not a conspiracy. It's just a problem trying to get everything, teachers trained on everything they need to be trained on. So we'd have a better understanding at the school of that child's strengths and his weaknesses or in her impairments and, you know, what they look like. Just a really good sort of evaluation process, you know, a little E, not necessarily a formal process, but, you know, that this school is really doing some things to try to understand that child better, what's going on with it. And then we ought to be working, in terms of school, we need to be working on reasonable goals for that child with a balanced life in mind. And let me say what I mean by that. There's a problem that sometimes comes up in schools that kind of works like this. He's going to have to do the same homework as everybody else because that's, you know, that's the way it is. And I'll say later that if it were up to me, the children with ADHD would not have any homework. Actually, it was up to me, children don't have any homework. That's another story. But, you know, in the world we're in, they're going to have homework. So sometimes teachers will say, well, you know, we can't really reduce that for him. And if you say, well, it takes us so much more time to get homework done than it would for a child who doesn't have ADHD. And teachers might say, yeah, we realize he's going to have to work harder and longer to get his homework done. And I don't think that's fair, you know, because there's more to life than school, and it's important. So time spent doing homework is not time spent with the kid in the backyard with his toes in the mud, or doing nothing, or playing imaginary games, or, you know, all these kinds of things that are important. So a school really shouldn't say to you, yeah, we know he's just going to have to spend more time doing everything he has to do. That's not really fair. Because he or she has a right to have a balanced life, which is hard enough, right? you don't have ADHD. And then in an ideal situation, we'd be working on sort of helping the child develop some skills, hopefully to try to address some of those executive function deficits like time management that we talked about so much, you know. And so kind of a skills approach. If this is a weakness, what can we do to try to help with that? So that's kind of in broad outline, that's what it ought to look like. But I want to just say this, in fairness to schools, and I'm a little bit biased because my wife's a retired school psychologist. She spent 30 years at Birmingham City Schools. I was an administrator in this district. And here's the other side of it. Now, you absolutely should, and you have to advocate for your child, even in a very fine school district like Mount Brook. And Mount Brook has a reputation for really taking good care of kids with special needs. I mean, we have people move into this town to try to figure out how the world would pay their mortgage because, you know, it has that kind of reputation. So I don't, that's not the issue. So you do that, but even then, you still have to be a little bit of a squeaky wheel. You know, you have to be willing to advocate. And part of the reason for that, to kind of go down this list, is you should just know that the number of students in any school district, including Mount Brook, that have been identified as having disorders and disabilities and things we have to address has expanded dramatically in just the last 10 years. More and more kids need what your kids need, or more, you know, depending on what they've got going on. And then not only is the number of kids we have to serve that have special problems increased dramatically, so have the things that we're supposed to do for them. So not only more kids, but deeper in terms of what we're supposed to provide, we need to provide. And yet, no increase in resources, no increase in funding. So that's why if you happen to glance over just in time to see it, somebody in your meeting kind of roll their eyes and think, oh my gosh, that's what it's about. It's how in the world. And I don't know how I feel about this, to be honest. I got into a debate about this at one of these conferences where there were people saying, you know, we need to provide huge amounts of service for all kids with ADHD. And I said, I get that. I mean, I've been an advocate for ADHD children my whole career. I don't have anything to apologize for. But that said, there's a peanut butter rule. You know the peanut butter rule? If you have a finite amount of peanut butter and bigger piece of bread, you got to spread it thinner. So my worry is that instead of serving relatively few kids better, we're going to serve a lot of kids not as well. Because we don't have increases in resources and staff and funding. So these are unfunded mandates, right? Y'all got to do more and more and more, but we can't help you. Right? So that I just only reason I say that is not to be defensive for the school. It's just for you to understand what they're up against. It's trying to figure out how to make this happen. And by the way, I shouldn't say this, but I'm going to because I'm tired. Everybody in the school district knows that if you have a child with ADHD and you're not happy with what you're getting, you can make a phone call to a federal office in Atlanta and ruin the lives of the administrators at school for about a year because they have to go through this process of dealing with the complaint. It's just, so I guess I mentioned all that just to say you should advocate for your child, but don't interpret the school's response as being a conspiracy or something. It's probably about, we got to figure out how in the world we're going to do this without adding people or adding services and adding. Okay, so if that angers anybody, I'm sorry, I just felt like I needed to say it. So some things to discuss with the school, I promised I'd say this. One is ask that question about staff training. And because it's a fair question. Y'all have learned how complicated and potentially dangerous and life-changing ADHD is, and it's also the most common disorder of childhood in this realm, and so their staff need to be trained, updated, and it's, again, that requires time and resources, nothing easy about it, but it's important. So another question to ask is, what's our plan? What is our plan for my student with ADHD? That's a very basic thing. We're past the time where in any good school district, nobody's going to say to you, yeah, your child's got ADHD, but they seem to be doing okay, so we don't need to do anything. Now you have a right to expect that the school's going to acknowledge the child has ADHD and is going to have something in place to respond to that. Now, what that is, you know, it could be a little bit, it could be a lot, depending on your individual child. But every child with ADHD ought to be recognized as having that disorder, and the school should be able to tell you what it is their plan is, right? And you work with them on that. You're a part of that process. Now, I'm not going to get into Section 504 of Special Ed in detail, and I'm just going to be blunt with you. Part of it is I don't want to say something to y'all. That's not my area. That's not really my specific area. And I don't want to say something to y'all that get me deposed later on if you get mad at school district. Right? But let me just, in broad outline. So there are two federal laws that potentially could govern what an ADHD child gets at school. And one is called Section 504, and the other is special education. Special education is often abbreviated IDEA, Individual Disability Education something.
I think it's an IED.
No, IEP is what you're thinking of. But the law is IDEA. I just can't remember what it stands for. Did I mention that this is not my area? So those are two different sort of federal laws. So let me just tell you in broad outline, and you can easily get good information about this online. So special education, what about ADHD and special education? You cannot be placed in special education on a diagnosis of ADHD in and of itself does not qualify a student for special education. So is there a learning disability? Does. Certain kinds of emotional problems? Does. Certain kind of cognitive deficits like low IQ scores? Yes. But there's no special education category for ADHD. In other words, my child has ADHD, therefore he should have special ed. Doesn't work that way. So in order to be eligible for special education, your child has to fit one of these categories as established by law. So with ADHD, your child may qualify for special education based on also having a learning disability. It would be the learning disability, like reading or math or written language, that would qualify him or her. He might be eligible for special education because of a category that's called other health impaired, which is a little bit more of a catch-all. And that may be how most kids with ADHD, if they are served under special education, that may be how they qualify as labeled OHI, other health impaired. If a child, on the special ed side, there's tremendous detailed law governing this. Rules, very, very, very detailed. And what it basically says is the school has to evaluate that child, determine whether he or she is eligible for special education. Then if they are eligible for special education, then a team writes an individual education plan, a customized plan for that child that includes special education services. Okay. So that's special ed. Section 504 is a different law, and basically it's a civil rights law. And the law says if someone is disabled, you cannot discriminate against them in the school. That's the fundamental of the law, the basics of the law. So virtually all children with ADHD are eligible for Section 504 protection, which at minimum means the school can't discriminate against So what does that mean? It would mean things like this. The school can't say to you, well, because your child has ADHD, she can't go on a field trip unless you come with her. All right? That'd be discriminatory. Right? So if a child is found eligible for Section 504, and most children with ADHD in 2020 are eligible, then the school's burden is to make sure they're not discriminated against because they have a disability. Now, one, a phrase that gets used about this is, what Section 504 is supposed to do is level the playing field, right? Do whatever they need to do so the child has the same access to education as everybody else. It is Section 504, if your child is eligible for Section 504, even this is even true of special ed, that doesn't mean that the school has a burden to make your child succeed. They don't have that burden. Under Section 504, they have a burden not to discriminate. But that's not, a lot of people come in and say, well, you have to write a plan to make sure my child gets straight A's and B's. Well, that's not right. The duty of the school district is to eliminate any discrimination related to ADHD. Now, y'all, this is tremendously complicated. I mean, somebody in the United States right now is doing a 5-day workshop on all this stuff. So I just urge you to, you know, chad.org, chadd.org, any of these major good ADHD resources will have a lot of information for you about this. So it's confusing. It's confusing sometimes to educators. There's a lot of, you know, and it's always changing. It's always changing because the regulations get rewritten or there's a court case someplace that changes things, whatever. All right, the other thing to discuss with schools is a reduction in your child's homework. I have felt strongly about this forever. And this is not just me, this is a very common thing. You have a right to ask the school to do a wholesale reduction of your child's homework. And I think I've got another slide with more details about this, about other modifications. My opinion is that a school in 2020 should not be saying to you, he has to do the same homework as everybody else the same way. I just don't think that's right. You know, if school says no way, you know, you got to decide what you want to do about that. But it's a fair thing to ask for and push for, and lots of data to back that up. Yes.
Is this across the board for all ages? I mean, are you talking even high school?
Yes. I mean, I think so. It's controversial in the sense that. In schools, it's controversial. Among ADHD professionals, it's not controversial. And again, I could be defensive about how this kind of thing hangs schools up and why people say what they say. But I think the data are very clear that it's the right thing to do, is to reduce. So, you know, this is an oversimplification of a complex problem, but it's a kind of a every other math problem approach. You know what I mean? So if everybody else is having to do 20 math problems at night, maybe your child with ADHD needs to do 10. So I think that's, to me, a neglected area in schools that are dealing with ADHD kids because there's all kinds of politics involved to be one. Have you noticed I have a tendency to be pulling that from? Then the other thing that you can ask about, and you have a right to ask about this, is that your child, if your child is impulsive, and if they have ADHD, it's a good chance they will be, then you have a right to ask for that to be considered if a disciplinary matter happens. So let's say that your kid gets in disciplinary trouble because a classmate walked by him and he just jabbed him in the ribs and hurt the kid. Right? So it would be reasonable to say, but for my child being impulsive, that probably wouldn't happen. So may we take that into account? Now, some parents, I think, frankly, take this way too far. And here's what they do. They say, my child has ADHD, they're impulsive, so therefore he should never be disciplined at the school for anything. And that's not fair either. Because frankly, a lot of times what the mischief kids get into at school doesn't have anything to do with impulsivity. If you have a kid who, or let's say Let's say you have a kid who is involved in a bullying thing, and he's a perpetrator of some bullying, and we discover that he, during the morning, he talked to some of his friends in the bathroom about how they might bully, say something ugly to this kid. So that implies thinking about it, planning about it. So don't assume that everything that your child does wrong is because of ADHD, but it's also a fair question to ask. That's why I say consider. Can we look at this situation and decide if impulsivity is really the reason this happened, and then adjust the discipline accordingly? And by the way, before, if a child does have ADHD and they're 504, remember Section 504, or special education, we don't do any major disciplinary action against a child before we go through a formal process to ask that question. Was what he did wrong related to his disability? And then there's this whole process, right? So that's fair. Okay, remember that almost nobody, this is a curse, that almost nobody the student encounters really understands this disorder. I got to really pick up the pace here. It's my fault. I've already talked about this. So homework, we should ask for it to be reduced in its amount, and maybe the student has more time to do it than other students. That there's something in place that you do or the school does to prompt the child to remember to get it done, more support for homework. So modification of homework, reduction, maybe you give them longer to get it done, something. That's really what I'm trying to say. Something to help prop it up. Homework is nightmarish enough for regular kids. It's particularly nightmarish for families with ADHD kids. Yes.
For some reason, this is not a problem for us at this point. We've been watching it. He enjoys school and loves doing his work and doing homework. He's in fourth grade. So what are we looking for in the future for when we need to intervene and say, okay, this is maybe getting to be too much for him? What are the triggers that we're looking
for? Yeah, that's just too big of a question for me to handle. So email. I'm serious. If I go off, it'll take a 10-minute answer.
Okay.
All right. Just, I don't know why I have this slide here. Do you have this slide? I hope you do somewhere. It's just these books have been around a long time. Oldies but goodies. They're all been revised several times. This is overall my favorite, Taking Charge of ADHD. It's by Russell Barkley, one of our leading scientists and educators. It's just rock solid. And I think this is right. I think it's in its third edition. I don't think there's a new edition to it. Barkley, I got to introduce him in Tuscaloosa. He's an amazing guy. He's contributed so much. Okay, so what about the ADHD family? So ADHD, is about, we know this, about troubled focus and attention and impulsivity and hyperactivity and poor regulation of emotions. And because ADHD is very often genetic, it means there's an excellent chance that a parent may have it, maybe both parents, or a couple siblings. So sometimes it's meaningful to think about the ADHD family. And in fact, in some places, particularly up in the Northeast, there are clinics now that just take a family approach to ADHD. They evaluate everybody. They treat everybody if they need to treat everybody, but take a family approach, and that frankly makes a great deal of sense. So what that often leads to is this kind of thing. Well, we have inattention and focus, so that gets us to pay attention. How many times have I told you? You never mind. You're so smart. Why are your grades low? Et cetera, et cetera. Hyperactivity is how could you have done that? What were you thinking? And all those kind of questions. And emotional dysregulation means a lot of calm down. And no, you calm down. And there's lots of frustration, lots of conflict, lots of shouting, lots of fussing. And then because it's hereditary, a parent with ADHD often has trouble following through and being consistent with discipline and medication and all those things, right? We talked about that. How that it took us way too long to figure that out. But a lot of times parents have trouble doing what they need to do to help their child because they themselves have the disorder, which makes it hard to be persistent, organized and all the things we need. So I don't mean to be pedantic about this, but it's just a good thing to remind ourselves that if ADHD is a disability, and I believe it is, it's hard to be the parent of a disabled person, a person with a disabled condition. And I think the reason I put that obvious thing there is I think that's a nice meditation for all of us if we are raising ADHD kids. Okay, this is supposed to be hard. There are just no shortcuts. There's no easy answers. There's no medication, as much as I believe in it. It's not the answer. It's just part of what we do. The discipline parenting piece, is complex. It's useful. I think that some of you may say, I just don't like thinking my child is being disabled. And that's fine. So that's why I've got disability with a little d, right? Just meaning they've got a condition that interferes with their ability, the ability and disability, to do the things we like when we get done. But the main thing on this is to not take it personally and not to go that this is just a rotten kid, he's just a behavior problem, he's just unmotivated, he's just this, he's just that. That's the value of keeping that perspective on disability. That your child is not getting up in the morning with the plan to make your life miserable, right? But that's not what it's about. So how can I make everybody mad at me today? That's not how that works. So it's a really good morning meditation for you. Sit in a lotus position on your bedroom floor and meditate on these issues. So you don't go here, right? That lady's kind of harmless under that. Okay, so Russell Barkley, the aforementioned Russell Barkley, has had these principles forever. I kind of modified for this presentation. I think this is really good stuff. ADHD kids need more feedback. They need more consequences, and positive and negative, with a big emphasis on positive. They need more acknowledgement of good behavior, staying out of your hair behavior, having a good day behavior. They need more, if they're going to be negative consequences, they're probably going to need those more frequently because they're going to have more trouble complying. They tend to need more powerful consequences, positive and negative. So they may not respond to a reward of running over to Smith's and getting something as much as other kids. They may need, you need to really consider what positive and negative consequences really work for your child. They also tend to wear out faster. So in other words, you say, boy, he really loves getting this reward, or he really responds to having his iPhone taken away on the punishment side. And then over time, that just doesn't seem working. So you have to be more creative, about changing it up, add things. But I don't mean to beat this to death, but I always do. Just don't neglect the positive side of all this. We don't need to be, it's amazing to me how many people equate discipline with negative consequences. And positive consequences are also a part, even probably more important part, frankly, of a discipline program. If discipline is really about trying to get your kids shaped up to do better, it's not just about punishment. In fact, I just think punishment's overrated. I just do. And particularly for ADHD kids. I think we really make a mistake by thinking of discipline as being about punishment and not about acknowledgement and praise and reward, all that kind of BS scare stuff, right? And then helping kids keep up with time. I think that's, we talked about that, the target effect, right? So that's important. Yes?
Do you loosen expectations then? If you have two other kids who don't do it and he does, is it okay that he doesn't do?
Yeah, that's a disability perspective.
Just, hey, don't worry if he doesn't do it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. And sometimes people say, this happens a lot in school districts. People say, in school districts, we often say, we have to be 100% consistent in how we do discipline in school so that a parent can't come in and say, well, you did something different for Joe Blow. And my response to that was always much more politely than what I'm about to put it. It's just none of your business what we do with Joe Blow. Your business, you know, you don't know that. We know that. We know what happened there, you know. So sometimes we can get too tied up in that. But the point I'm trying to make is part of it of ADHD is adjusting expectations.
That's hard when you have other children. It is. It's just impossible.
But it's not impossible. But it does call for a transparency and being able to have children understand why that's the case, which goes back to the whole idea of the more people who understand ADHD, the better. So it may mean that the siblings have to come to a better understanding of what ADHD is. Nobody will catch me saying that's easy. I just think it's important. Strive for being consistent. The reason I say strive is you can't be consistent all the time. You got a migraine today. Your in-laws are visiting. act, don't yak. That's a cliche that's been around for a while. Here's what that means. We have a tendency, American parents, and I'm sorry, but the data tell us, this is generally more true of mothers than fathers, but it's still true of parents, is that we have a tendency to rely too much on lecturing and talking and not enough action. Kids, I don't think kids respond very well to yakking at them. Wah, 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 wah. It's Charlie Brown's teacher, right? So we do that, but there's not really any evidence that it really helps to lecture and nag our kids. It's perfectly human, but as I'm fond of saying, don't confuse them with something that will help them. So we need more action. This is kind of all business, low-key, action. Plan ahead for problem situations. So if you're about to go into that every time you go into the Belks, your six-year-old likes to hide in the circular clothing rack. Every child does that at least once, right? Where you have that panic worries and they come back. So if you know there are situations like that where your child's going to have a problem, I think I have something on this later. I'm going to say it now. I beg you to trust me that what I'm about to say is true. I'm not saying this is a cure-all, but you would be surprised at how often it will help. Is you're about to go into Belk's, and just before you walk in, you turn your child around, you stoop down, you look at him, and you say, "We're about to go in the store. Here's what I need from you. I don't need you to be, and you sort of go through some of the things." You'd be stunned, I think, at how often that, I call that the briefing. You do a little briefing. Here's what I expect. We're about to go into a restaurant. And, here's what, we're not going to be yelling. You're not going to be playing with your iPad. The little pre-event briefing will buy you a lot of cooperation. It won't fix everything. It doesn't work for every child, but always worth doing. Don't take it personally. Practice forgiveness. Isn't that good? Sometimes... the way we used to put this in rural Arkansas is there's a lot of trouble in life, and sometimes you just have to let the loose ends drag. You can't. Sometimes you have to say, okay, it's okay. I know, yes, you broke the pot, the vase in the living room playing soccer. Here's the consequence, and yes, you are also forgiven. Move on. Got to take care of ourselves, got to eat our Wheaties, got to go to the gym. I should do that. We got to take care of ourselves in order to be able to have the energy available to deal with this. It's nice to have local grandparents or people that you can, put the kids with date night, quick trip to the beach, whatever you have to do. And then we all need a solid discipline program, which is what I'm going to spend most of the rest of the time talking about. So what does a solid discipline program look like? Okay, here's what I've overview. Appropriate use of time out. Which I'm going to go over a little bit. The quick thing to say about time out is a lot of people say, done it, been there, done that, doesn't work for my child. That almost always means the parent didn't do it right. For time out, the devil is in the details. And so I'm going to try to walk you through that. It really takes me 9 minutes to teach people to do time out. I'm going to try to give you a short version and maybe suggest some things you can look at. Try to shift the balance so that there's plenty of positive interaction and it's not just fussing and punishing. So that's the principle. Related to that, we need to do a more low-key acknowledgement of good behavior. Hey, way to go, and move on. I think I said this already. It doesn't mean that every time you catch your child being good, you gotta, you know, take them to the ice cream place or buy them something Smith. It just means, most of the time it just means, hey, thank you so much, way to go. Right, just that kind of acknowledgement can go a lot of way with a lot of kids. I'm an unapologetic opponent of spanking. That's generally true. Y'all, I don't come at this from some kind of fuzzy-headed shrink perspective. I grew up in the woods of Arkansas. Had a switch applied to my hiney more than once. But I have to give my advice based on data. And the data about corporal punishment could not be clearer. It's a bad idea. And it's a particularly bad idea for kids with ADHD. That's an overview. I'm going to say a little bit more about it. We also have to, this is part of taking care of ourselves, we have to do all we can to manage our own anger. Because it's when we get really, really angry, we can go off the rails a little bit, you know. And look, in fairness, I don't think there's anything that will bring out a parent's fury more than a nakedly defiant child. If you, when they look up at you and say, you ain't the boss of me and you can't make me do it, that brings out the worst in all of us. That's when you just want to beat them half to death, right? I get it. But again, that's not to be confused with something that will help a child. Our anger is not going to help a child. It's not going to help us either. In fact, our anger often is just going to make us do unwise things. I'm doing it a lot. I mentioned I'm doing a full-day workshop tomorrow about why teenagers engage in high-risk behavior. And one of the reasons for it is when we are emotionally aroused, including like being excited, we don't think clearly. And that's true of all of us. So if we're really angry, we're just not thinking clearly. Right? And our judgment's impaired. So we have to control. And that's also why it's okay if we're really angry at our child, it's okay to say, I'm not going to deal with this right now. I'll deal with it tomorrow. I'll deal with it when I get calmed down. Again, contra the popular attitude that unless you deal with the issue right now, you might as well not do it. That's not true. It can wait. A six-year-old is capable of understanding that he's being punished today for something he did yesterday. He can get that, right? All right. We need to kind of define our goals for the child. What are they? What's appropriate for them, realistic? We've got to reward small achievements. And then by rewarding and acknowledging positive behavior, you're helping your child feel successful. And that increases their motivation to do the right thing. Let's get more concrete. So, how many times have I told you, right? That's a trap. And we're going to talk about how to break out of that. This slide is probably unnecessary. How can we come back to that? That'll work. Discipline is related to our overall relationship with the child. Discipline works best when they know we love them, they love us, they trust us. So I wish I had 2 hours to talk about this because so much depends on this almost spiritual, mystical thing, which is the quality of the relationship between the parent and the child. When that's pretty good, when it's good, discipline works. When it's not good, discipline fails. I almost regret bringing it up because there's so much to be said about that. So I'll just add, the time we spend cultivating a positive, trusting relationship with the child is the fuel for disciplined work. If our kids deeply resent us because we're verbally abusive and ugly and don't spend enough time with them, they will do everything they can to defeat your discipline program. We have to change discipline as a child develops. That's my special talent for stating things that are completely obvious. It has to be based on mutual respect. It wasn't mutual. So obviously we want our kids to respect us, but that's a two-way street. We have to acknowledge these children, you know, as real human beings with real feelings, and we're respectful of that. We don't dismiss their feelings. We, you know, So, does effective discipline isn't always effective? Because it's a process, right? Discipline is a process, there's nothing we do in life that's always effective, right? So effective discipline isn't always effective. It requires planning and patience and not operating on the fly. Okay? So we have your program, ready. It's harder for ADHD kids because they have trouble attending to our directions. They have trouble persisting. Our rewards tend to wear off. Punishment's not as effective. Spanking's a waste of time at best, and probably harmful. And then we have this kind of bad kid role they get shaped into. We say to them, you never listen, and you never mind. And so after a while, they start believing that. They start internalizing our fussing at them. That's how it impacts their, self-worth, self-esteem, and all that. So we have responsibilities to be clear in communicating what we want and controlling our emotions when we're upset and disciplining kids. Not fighting dirty, not name-calling, not being hurtful. Those are our duties. We have to try to be more grown up than our kids. Not always easy. Got to plan, got to control the bar. By the way, this thing about confidence, I think sometimes half the battle is for your kids to feel like you know what you're doing. I'm on this, I'm good. If you are fearful and filled with self-doubt, your kids will know it, they'll smell it, and take advantage of it. Okay. I'm moving. Which of these children have trouble listening to mine? All of them. Because learning to listen to mine is a process. It takes a long time. If you're married, you know that your spouse sometimes has trouble not even listening. It's a developmental process, never ending, right? Why won't my child listen? Which is often the same thing as why won't he do what I say, right? Well, the ability to listen in mind has to develop for all of us. It's got to be learned, it's got to be taught. And it's a long process. Kids are going to test the limits. And that's because this is what's going through their minds all the time. When do I get to be in charge? So I have a grandson, Blaze, who's 5 years old, about to turn five. And Blaze, yesterday, my wife had him for the afternoon, and she said, your mama said you have to do X, Y, Z. I can't remember what it was. And Blaze said, I want to be the boss. Well, that's perfect. That's when do I get to make my decisions? And that's something that really begins when they're toddlers and continues through the high school years. Can I just make a decision about whether or not I'm going to go to this party? Can I make a decision about whether I do my homework when I do it? That's why kids will test the limits, They're trying to figure out whether they get to make decisions or you're going to make the decisions for them. That's a normal, healthy process. Sometimes kids won't listen because we don't communicate very well about what we want. And then this is the big thing we're about to launch into, we sometimes teach our children not to listen to us and not to mind until we have screamed out. All right, so let me make a note, that's what we're going to talk about in a minute, how it is we get ourselves in a situation where our children won't really mind until we're screaming at them or threatening them. Okay, so hold on to that. All right, so a couple things about being heard and getting kids to mind. And the first step in getting kids to mind and listen to us is they have to literally hear us. So this is hailing, orienting, and phrasing. Hailing means when you are about to say something to a child that you really want them to hear, say their name. Sarah, until Sarah looks at you, says, yes, ma'am, yes, sir, later. Hailing, it's important. If your child's over here playing with Legos and you just start talking to them, it's like, boy, they don't get it. So you get their focus and attention on you. Haley. Orienting means trying to get eye contact. Ooh, look at him. About to say something to you, I want you to do. And then the phrasing. All right, so consider. Would you please do mommy a favor and do, and sometime get your dirty socks off the floor? Or what is that? Would you please? So a six-year-old says, would I please do mommy a favor? I think I shall not. Apparently it's an option. Because it's exactly what you said. You're phrasing that as a favor. You're phrasing it as something optional. It's not what you mean. What you mean is get your socks off the floor. But you, the child processes that as, I'm busy. Versus, please pick up your, Sarah, please pick up your socks and take them and put them in the dirty clothes. I need to redo it now. Please. Just please. It's a command. It's a directive. Ends with a period, not a question mark. What's the other problem with this? And would you do mom a favor and sometime? Okay, so if my wife says to me, sometime I wish you'd clean out your closet. I say, would 2024 work out okay for you? So we have to, we don't do sometime. We want an effective man, we say now. Now. I need to redo it now. So that just that, those changes make a difference. I mentioned this earlier. Prepare the child for problem situations. That's the huddle that you have before you go into a situation you know may be problematic. How about if we try to inform kids rather than accuse? So if we say, you always leave your wet towel on the bathroom floor. That phrasing requires the child to search for forensic evidence that you're wrong. So when you say you always leave your, I didn't last Tuesday. Right. By the way, that's the same thing in marriages. If you say you never listen to me when the ball game's on, you say, there's an Iron Bowl 2013, I believe I did listen to her. So accusations require us to defend themselves. So let's not. Instead, we give information. An accusation is you always leave dirty clothes on the floor. Information is dirty clothes belong in the hamper. Stop yelling is an accusation. Information is I hear you better when you're calm and your voice is modulated. Hurry up is an accusation. So fussing at accusation. Time is short. I need to read it. You make a choice. Is information. Nag versus questions. How many times have I told you to wash your face is nagging. What can you do to get your face clean is a question that prompts a solution. Take out the garbage becomes what job did you agree you'd do earlier? All right. Get dressed becomes what's the best way to get dressed when we get out the door? So these are just difference in verbal behavior that instead of setting up defensiveness tend to set up more introspection and cooperation. I'll take a question in a second. Don't eat that crap becomes what are some healthy food choices? Why are you acting like this in the store? How will you let me know you're tired and ready to go home? You can't watch that show becomes how can we be sure you're watching appropriate shows? Just a couple years ago, my grandson Henry, who's now 8 years old, we're watching TV. I think I was watching CNN or something. And he's sitting on, it's time to suck his thumb. And he said, we're watching CNN, which is a bad idea, you know. Henry goes, could you put on something appropriate for me? All right, so.
Or less boring for him.
Less boring, less agitating for me. Yes.
I read sometimes with ADHD children that it's kind of going back to what you're saying, sometimes it's just too much talk, that they say that sometimes it's very effective to give the child's name and one action word. Like instead of, Luke, go get in the car. You know, just say, Luke, car.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I completely agree with
Luke,
that.
Luke, shoes. You know, give one word.
Let's go back to my wet towel thing. You could say, I don't know how many times I've told you, or you could say, towel. That's plenty of information.
Yeah.
And okay. Without all the,
you don't think that's too barky, a little bit too sergeant? I don't mind Sergeant, I'm just saying, you know.
Yeah. It's all about the tone. Sarah. Tao. This one.
Tao.
Right.
Actually, I do it more to my husband than I do to Tao. Looking at all this thinking.
All right, so there's a spiral. I shifted around some slides and I thought I had these lined up the way I wanted them, but apparently I haven't, so I apologize. All right, so there's a spiral. I'm sorry. All right, I'm gonna skip a couple things and go to this, because this help, it's gonna help us understand. How do we get to this point, right? Okay, so they were fussing and yelling at Junior. All right, so let's take this scenario. You're walking through the house, and Caleb's over here playing with his Legos and with dirty socks on the floor next to him. I don't know why I'm in the dirty socks today. And you go through the basket of laundry, whatever, and you look at the back of his head, and you say, "Hey, Caleb, would you please do Mommy a favor and sometime pick up your dirty socks, put them in the dirty hamper?" Ouch, good. Okay, that's round one, what I just did, model for you. At this point, Caleb's saying, "Did I hear something?" That's all it was. You're talking to the back of his head. You didn't, I don't know if you hailed him or not. But, you know, just bop, bop, you know, just, he's involved. It's like he didn't hear anything. So then you go back through the second time, and you... he's exactly where he was before. And so you say, "Hey, I think I told you to pick up your dirty socks." And, you know, and you, so you're ramping it up a little bit. And he's saying, "You know, she's not that mad yet. I'm good." Now, this is unconscious. Now, he's not necessarily sitting there thinking that. That's what's going through his head. He's saying, "Yeah, she's okay. She's starting to get irritated, but I've got some play left in the system. And I'm in this little play like us. I'm good." We go through another time and we say, "I cannot believe this. How many times have I told you?" And then, you know, we're kind of raising our, we're up in the ante a little bit. "She's not that mad yet. I'm still good." Then we, then he, you know, another round of it escalating. She says, he's DEFCON 3. You know, I'm just about out of play here. And then we say, "Ah," you know, we just scream and threaten and so forth. And he says, "Okay, she's screaming. So as a result of this pattern, which is extremely well documented on, in the research that parents do this, what we have done is we are trained our kids not to pay attention to us and not to mind to restrain them because we didn't follow through on any of the previous steps. That's the, I call that the disciplinary death spiral, which we need to break out of. All right. Remind me to go back at some point. We're out of order here. I'm sorry, y'all. I'm safe. Here's how you break out of the spiral. You change your program so that you give your directive, your command. I hate to use the word command because it sounds like you're talking to a German Shepherd. You know, what it is you want done, your directive. Do this, stop doing that, it's obnoxious, whatever it is. You give one directive that's clear. You hail them, made eye contact, you state it as a directive and not a question, right? Then if they don't comply, don't get up and do it, you give one warning. And the warning is, if you don't do what I said, then X, whatever the consequence is going to be. And then, if they don't mind, then you apply that consequence come hell or high water, because you made that commitment, right? So that's the overview. The directive given properly. If you get compliant, you say thank you very much and you move on. If you don't comply, they don't comply, you give them one warning. If you don't do what I said, then there's consequences. If they comply, you acknowledge and say thanks. If they don't, then you apply the consequence. Whether it's timeout or taking away the iPhone or whatever it is. If, by the way, if at that point he says, "Okay, I'll do it," it's too late. Because if you say, if you give in then you're basically saying you got to take this to the wire every time. That's not what you want. You want them to hear you, respond, know there's a consequence if they don't. That's how you break out of the cycle. So, clear direction, warning, child doesn't mind. All right, so let's talk about timeout. Now I'm going to try this and go backwards. Now, timeout works very well from somewhere around, for most kids, somewhere around 2, 2.5, maybe 3, just depends on your child, roughly until puberty. Now, there are differences of opinion about that among psychologists. But it's my workshop, so that's my opinion. That's what it seems to work the best. There are two things, so, all right, there are, I can't believe this. Oh, yeah, here we go. So there are two things that trigger using timeout. One is what we've been talking about just for the last few minutes, that you've given a clear direction, they didn't mind, you gave a clear warning, they still didn't mind, then they go to timeout. And we'll talk about the details of timeout. So that's one way to get it to use timeout. The other way to use timeout is when your child breaks a rule that's clearly established in your household. Don't hit your sister. Don't play soccer in the living room. If those are clearly established, then you don't do a warning, they just go to timeout. Does that make sense? Two pathways to timeout. So the first time you use timeout, and if you tried it before and it hadn't worked, you're starting over. So this is like the first time. In a calm moment, driving to Target or whatever, you go over with your child in a transparent way how it's going to look. So here's what we're going to do. You know how sometimes I ask you to do something, you don't do it, and I get mad, you get mad, blah, blah, blah. Here's how we're going to start doing this. I'm going to, and you tell them. Say, I'm going to let you know what I need for you to do, and then I'm going to tell you one time, I'm going to give you one warning. And then if you don't do it, if you do it, great. If you don't do it, you're going to go time out. So that, again, this is one of those trust Dale kind of things. You will buy a lot of cooperation by respectfully bringing the kid in on advance. Now, you can't do this in the middle of a disciplinary moment, because he's mad, you're mad, everybody's mad. So you do it at a calm moment. I'm a big, big believer in that kind of briefing with kids. It builds respect and buys a lot of cooperation. Okay. Then there's this thing called the hump. Okay. So let's say you got a kid who tends to be a little bit oppositional. Like you say tomato, they say tomato, I ain't going to do it, they don't know. And you say to them, hey, look, here's the deal. We're going to start having this deal where I'm going to tell you what to do, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and if you don't do what I said, then you're going to sit in the corner, or, you know, whatever. Any self-respecting child is going to think to themselves, yeah, I'm not a big fan of this plan, so I need to do whatever I can to defeat this nonsense. And what they do then, many of them, is the first time you do timeout, they pitch a holy They just go bonkers and scream and holler and cry and kick. So a lot of parents will say, oh my gosh, this is clearly not going to work for my child. And then they give it up. And then you've taught this lesson, by the way. If I pitch a fit that's long enough and loud enough, they'll capitulate. This is not a good message. So the first, I still remember this like it was yesterday and not 36 years ago. First time we did timeout with my oldest daughter, probably 2.5 years old, that's what we went through. So that's very important. All right, so the purpose of timeout is really not so much punishment as making sure they're not getting rewarded for their misbehavior. So you're about to do timeout, and I've already talked about how you get timeout, right? Command, warning, non-compliance, timeout. Breaking a rule, everybody knows, you don't hit your sister, going to timeout. So then you announce timeout, you're going to timeout. Not, honey, you're going to have to go to timeout because we had talked about this. It's going to be hard for me, it is for you. That's going to be active. This is all business. You're going to timeout. Confidently, clearly, unambiguously. Just like Joe Biden said, he is going to win South Carolina. You want to have that kind of confidence, right? Observe them. All right, so when they're in timeout, there's a lot of physical ways to do timeout, but and we'll talk about that in a second. But, you know, like you may have a sitting chair in a corner. I call that the desk, and then it's maneuver, right? But you want to be able for them to be in timeout in your house in a place where you can see them being in timeout. You can observe them, but also you can go about your business. In other words, you don't need to be there with them, holding them, talking to them, or any of those things. So, you know, you're puttering around in the kitchen, and you're looking over the island, and you can see that he's over there in the dining room chair, turned around, looking at the corner. More details coming. These are basic guidelines. No eye contact during timeout, no talking, no lecturing, no nothing. The idea about timeout is the child ought to be in a state of sensory deprivation. No, no conversation, nothing entertaining, absolute boredom. That's what you're going for. Isolated from others, can't interact with people. The general rule is about 1 to 5 minutes in timeout with added time to get calm. Now there's another, and give me a minute on that. Another guideline people sometimes use is you spend 1 to 2 minutes in timeout for every year of age. Heard that one before. So you have a 7-year-old, they do something, you know, you'd go 7 to 14 minutes. Some of the best research we have is that short amounts of time in timeout work as well as longer. So you'd think 15 minutes of timeout would be better than 5 minutes of timeout. Turns out not to be true. And so it may literally be something where you do 1 to 5 minutes. You just have to play with this yourself to find out what works. But in order to, okay, so I'm going to talk to you timeout. So you got to the point where you do timeout. You say, all right, it's time for timeout. Physically, again, the idea is boredom. So you could have them sitting in a chair, staring down a hallway. You could have, you don't want them looking out a window, right? Don't want them in view of a television set. You don't want them listening to audio. You know, just whatever it is, boredom. At our house, we had them sit on the stairs. It's worked fine. So that's how we do with time zones. So then they, and I'm going to get to what do you do if they refuse. I'm going to get to that, right? All right, so they go to timeout. They have to sit quietly. Can't be putting their feet on the walls. They got to sit there. Don't have to be motionless. But, you know, you don't want them rocking the chair back, getting up and down. They got to sit there. And that's why short periods of time seem to work pretty well. All right, so you set the timer, right? So you could do an Alexa timer. I still like those big Sunbeam kitchen timers. They tick, you know, and everything. Yellow plastic, but whatever. You set a timer. So you're going to be 5 minutes of timeout. You set the timer. Then, in order for the child to get out of timeout, they have to meet 3 conditions. All right, I told you this is kind of anal retentive. The devil's in the details. First condition is to have to serve their minimum sentence. The timer has to go, they have to be there for 5 minutes or whatever it is. That's the first thing. The second thing they have to do is they have to be calm at the end of it. In other words, if they're hollering and screaming and carrying on, they don't come out of timeout. Because if you let them out of timeout when they're hollering and screaming and carrying on, the message is they get out if they holler, yell, and scream. So you say to them, you can get out of timeout when you calm down. I don't include in that crime. I don't hold crying against kids. I do hold against them pitching a fit, telling you you're the meanest parents in Mountain Brook, you know, being abusive. So they have to just calm down. Right. And the third thing they have to do, you can tell I'm Catholic, I got some Latin, they have to do mea culpa, my fault. So that means apologizing to our sister for hitting her. It means picking up their dirty socks, which is how you got into this mess, right? They just got to do whatever. They got to go back to square one and do whatever it is. Try to undo what they did that was wrong by apologizing or making amends of some kind. Or doing the thing that you ask them to do, or had them do that they didn't get it. Okay. So, to anticipate some problems, first of all, remember the hump. The hump means that a child may not voluntarily go sit in the chair. And so I ain't doing it. And so you've got, as far as I know, you've got two choices of how to handle refusal. One is you can just physically make them sit, which is perfectly appropriate if you're dealing with a six-year-old. You know, you pick them up, put them in a chair, and if you have to hold them there, you hold them there. So the way to do that, by the way, just to show you, is if you've got a child who won't stay in the chair, is you get them in the chair, and you sit behind them, and you're not going to have to do this forever. You're just going to have to do it until they realize you're not backing down, and then they'll go to timeout voluntarily. So they're here, and you're behind them, also in a dining room chair. You take their left hand, your right hand, cross their arms like this, and you just hold them. And keep your head back so you don't lose them. Your head back. And you don't want to say, oh my gosh, this is so hard, that's reinforcing. It is okay to say, it's okay, it's okay. This little quiet reassurance, and you ride it out. In 30 years or so of teaching people how to do timeout, I think I had one or two cases where nothing worked to make time, nothing parents did could make timeout work. And those are children who had much more severe psychiatric problems than I thought. This works. It just works if you can do it the right way. So the other choice you have, and this is better probably for older kids, or if you're just not comfortable with that kind of physical deal, is you do what I call a death penalty. The death penalty is, look, you can spend 6 minutes in timeout, or you're not going to see an electronic screen for 3 weeks. Give them, a rock and a hard place. Give them a choice. Be sure the death penalty is something you're willing to do, right, and not going to back off of it. And also, don't be troubled if your child says, I'd rather never have another screen, rather do what you say. Whatever. That's just rhetoric, right? It's just trying to get you to back down. So you can't give that choice. That's an alternative to a physical intervention. Make sense? Say a little bit about spanking. I know this is another example of people, not the way y'all aren't paying me anything. I used to say people pay me very good money for ignoring my advice. And this is probably the best example of this. First of all, let's really define what I mean by spanking or corporal punishment. Let's say you have a 4-year-old and you're at the parking lot at Brookwood Mall, and when you get him out of the car, he pulls away from you and runs across the parking lot and nearly gets hit by a Yukon, right? If you catch up with him and give him a quick swat on the hind, no jury in Jefferson County would convict you for that, neither would I. I don't even think of that as corporal punishment so much as I do as an innovative method of communication. You got to quickly get that child's attention. But I'm not really talking about that. I'm talking about wait your daddy gets home, bend over, and let me hit you on the butt with a board or whatever it is. I'm categorically opposed to that. Here's what the data said. Nobody cares about data anymore. I know that. But nobody cares about the research. They care about their gut and what happened to them when they were kids. But here's what the data tells. Spanking as a disciplinary tool increases aggression in children in the long run. It also is ineffective in anything, including teaching kids to be responsible and control themselves. New evidence is that it may actually cause harm to the child by affecting brain development. You say, how in the world does spanking affect brain development? And spanking is, if it's done a lot, it's very stressful, releases stress hormones in the body. Other methods that teach children right from wrong are safer and more effective. That's why people should. Here's another way to put it. Here's my thing. The last people in North America you're legally allowed to hit are children. You cannot hit your spouse. You cannot hit your boss. You cannot hit a stranger in a bar. You know, so there, you can hit people in the boxing ring, and you can hit children. Everything else is illegal. I just think it's time to stop hitting children. Sorry, to me it's just that simple. And particularly when we know it doesn't work. And people often say to me, "Oh, Dale, I know spanking works because my parents spanked me all the time, and I turned out fine." And I always want to say, "Yeah, I know you. I'm not sure you did." Or a better, more professional response to that is, you don't have any way of knowing how you would have turned out if your parents didn't spank you. That's just speculation. The other one I love is, I believe I'd be in prison if my parents didn't spank me. A lot of visited prisons, and what you find in prison are people who got spanked out of their life. You don't see people in prison never got spanked. Right? I could go on about this. So you can ignore my advice or not, but it's not just my advice. The American Academy of Pediatrics does not take this kind of position without compelling research. And they take a position that stop spanking. We need to acknowledge goodness. We need to work on our relationship, trust, affection, spending no agenda time together. So no agenda time. Oh, okay. So research tells us that discipline, including things like timeout, don't work unless it's balanced by positive approaches. Let me say that again. Negative disciplinary actions do not work unless they're balanced by positive approaches to things. So one of the things that's routinely recommended by psychologists, and I taught this method for many years, this comes from Russell Barker's work, by the way, is that part of trying to get your child to do better, mind better, is you make a discipline out of spending time with them that we call no agenda time. No agenda time is like this. You say, okay, we're going to spend, you do this twice a week, 20 minutes. And you say, okay, it's time for our special time. And let's say you got an 8-year-old. What you're saying to him is, we're going to spend this time together in any way you want, within reason. So he may say, okay, why don't you sit with me? I'm going to play with my G.I. Joes. That dates me, whatever the equivalent of G.I. Joes is. And it may just be that your 8-year-old just wants to slam them together, you know, and do all kinds of just like not very interesting things. And your job is to sit and watch and do color commentary. And you're slamming your G.I. Joes together. You don't direct it. You're just there. And it's amazing how it works. I can't tell you how many times I taught people this. I said, please trust me. I said, oh, okay. They come back and say, oh my gosh, things are so much better now. You know, I guess you could call it quality time, but it's, we call it no agenda time. So that's another 2-hour talk. But I can't overstate the importance of it. If it's going to the park and just being there with them, those things really make a difference, probably because it works on the relationship piece, right? Okay. That's no agenda time. And that was a disclaimer. All right, now we're back to where we are. I've got a little, so before I go any further, I've got a little bit more I want to do, but questions? It's a lot of information. If you want to really do timeout well, a really good resource are the books by Thomas Phelan. I think I have one on your list. His name is Phelan. There are also some videos around the time. Those are the so-called 1-2-3 magic books, and it's good stuff. And then there are other resources that are out there.
Will you say his name one more time?
Yeah, it's Thomas Phelan, Phelan. And there's several books, but they're all, the core and the title is 1-2-3 magic. oh, you got your child in timeout. Oh gosh, you're so much. Got your child in timeout, and here's some things they might do while they're in timeout. I gotta pee. Easy. Go pee, and then when you come back, we'll resume timeout. I mean, that's not hard. Or you could say, no, we're almost done. You can hold it. That's fine. I'm going to throw up. Well, I hope you don't. We'll clean it up. You wouldn't do this to me if you loved me. I do love you, but I'm doing this because I do love you. But, you know, there are always just, that's just rhetoric. You just, just be calm and cheerful about it. Don't take it to heart. Oh, public places. So your child does something that, that makes them deserving of time out at church. So what are your, whatever, what are your choices? One choice, you could take them immediately and find a corner someplace in the church, time them out at church. That's what we did. If our kids misbehaved in the grocery store, I just take them over, make them stand at the frozen foods and stare at a bag of lima beans, you know. I go about my business, get a copy of Esquire and read it. Because I have no capacity for public embarrassment. We did that all the time. You can also wait. Say, well, when we get home, we're going to do timeout, as long as you do it. Another problem. My child needs to be put in timeout at 7:15 in the morning. I need to get him to school. Okay? The answer to that is you do timeout after school for what they did at 7:15. They can make the connection. The main reason psychologists say try not to delay like that has nothing to do with the child, it has to do with the parent, to be blunt. So at 7:30 in the morning, you know they're supposed to, they need to get time out when you get home. Then when you get home, the sun's shining and the birds singing, and you just don't want to go there. Perfectly understandable. It's really about parents, not about kids. Kids can draw a bit. One more quick one from our history of doing time out with our kids is we'd be driving to the beach. And, you know, child A would slap child B in the back seat. That's an occasion for timeout. So how do you timeout? Drive a car. Here's how we would do it. You pull into the next pilot, you know, or whatever, and you sit in the parking lot, and everybody's still strapped in, and you do timeout. Everybody sit in the car, you do timeout. So we're in timeout. It's funny because the situation, the child's pretty much the same as it was a few minutes ago. They're all strapped into the car, but you're not going anywhere, and you're in timeout. That's how it works. So, anyway, some of the common problems with timeout. Questions? All right, let me do a little bit more, and we're almost on track. As they get older, this also, some of this applies to young kids, but think about like disrespectful behavior, you know, like what about adolescents, teenagers? What do we do about kids that are disrespectful and they challenge and they don't do what we say and they misbehave? That's a big, it's a big topic. We try not to be too reactive. We don't have to, again, we shouldn't respond when we're mad. Take a long haul approach. So I'm going to give you an example of a long haul approach. We did this one a couple times. So let's say that on Tuesday night, your 13-year-old says something sassy and disrespectful. Or they don't mind. You know, something you ask them to do, they don't do it, whatever it is. But, so let's say it's sassy, disrespectful. On Tuesday night, here's what you might do. You might say, you know, you may not speak to me that way. I don't deserve it, and I'm not going to have it. And don't do anything else. Just do that. Then you, what I call lying, holding a grudge and lying in wait. So, that's on Tuesday night, right? A lot of people are writing down, hold a grudge. On Friday night, she says to you, can you give me a ride to Cheryl's house? And you say, no. And then you have to revive them with smelling salts when they hit the floor. And they say, why not? And you say, you were really rude to me on Tuesday night, and I'm just not in the habit of doing nice things for people who are rude to me. Okay. By the way, I gotta say this. That approach I developed as a result of dealing with one of my partners when I was in practice. For a short time, I had a psychologist in practice and he was just jerkish, just rude, and disrespectful, all kinds of things. She didn't last long, but at one point she called me and she said, I just had a belly full of it. And I'm not a confrontational guy, I'm sorry. Anyway, she calls me and said, I got something come up, would you take my call this weekend? And I said, no. And she said, why not? And I said, you've just been so ugly, I'm just not going to do nice things for people who are ugly too. And I thought, that could work for teenagers. So sometimes teenagers say, does it really matter whether I follow the rules? Think about a Mount Brook student, Mount Brook 16-year-old, 15-year-old, who's kind of rude, obnoxious, and doesn't do what you want. And what happens? They have nice vacations, they go to a beautiful school, they have a nice car to drive. So when a teenager says, what does it really matter if I follow the rules? Maybe they have a point. Everybody following me? Their life's pretty sweet, whether they're nice to you or not, or whether they're taking care of the responsibility. I mean, that's a real danger in a community like ours. So here's a meditation for you. What do we owe our kids? In other words, what are the non-negotiables that we have to give them? Here's your Uncle Dale's, I think, complete list of the non-negotiables. These are things we have to do for them. We have to give them food and water. We have to provide shelter. We have to make sure they get educated. We have to make sure they get health care. We have to make sure they have clothing. Not necessarily the latest and the hottest, but something that will cover their nakedness. And they need protection from danger to some extent. Can't protect them from all dangers. That's what we owe them. Everything else ought to be a contract. It ought to be kind of a, you know, I'll do this for you. I don't have to do your laundry. I do not have to provide you a car to drive. We do not have to go. We are not going to do vacations that you're included in when you're a jerk all the time. You know. Right. So we provide our child's basic needs, but we make the rest a kind of a deal. The deal being, I, as your parent, will enrich your life in exchange for you being respectful and civil, basic obedience, taking care of your responsibilities. And I don't think we do that enough. You know? So that's how teenagers get to a point where they might say, I don't think it really matters whether I'm obnoxious or doing what I'm supposed to be doing or not. It's a real danger for us. Right? So that's how I think we try to avoid raising a kid who's poor. Holy cow, there's a lot of stuff in 90 minutes. I'm going to hang around for a minute or two. Anybody got one more quick question? What time is it? Is it 30? Okay. Might be on track. Okay. I know I'm overwhelmed. You have my email address. I say again, I am just so grateful for y'all for coming.